Our second reading this morning is from Luke chapter 6, verses 17 through 26 in the New Revised Standard Version. Listen now to the gospel according to Luke. He came down with them and stood on a level place with a great crowd of his disciples and a great multitude of people from all Judea, Jerusalem, the coast of Tyre and Sidon. They had come to hear him and to be healed of their diseases, and those who were troubled with unclean spirits were cured. And all in the crowd were trying to touch him, for power came out from him and healed all of them. Then he looked up at his disciples and said, "Blessed are you who are poor, for yours is the kingdom of God. Blessed are you who are hungry now, for you will be filled. Blessed are you who weep now, for you will laugh. Blessed are you when people hate you and when they exclude you, revile you, and defame you on account of the Son of Man. Rejoice in that day and leap for joy, for surely your reward is great in heaven. For that is what their ancestors did to the prophets. But woe to you who are rich, for you have received your consolation. Woe to you who are full now, for you will be hungry. Woe to you who are laughing now, for you will mourn and weep. Woe to you when all speak well of you, for that is what their ancestors did to the false prophets." This is the good news. In the mid-1970s, my parents owned a used Ford Country Squire station wagon. I know. It was roughly the size of a cruise ship and had a loud 8-cylinder engine that got about 2 miles to the gallon of regular gasoline. Remember regular gasoline? Its exterior was painted a sickening shade of green with a matching vinyl interior that stuck to your skin in hot weather. And it had faded fake wood trim on the side and rear panels. It was a feast for the senses and a menace to the environment. But none of that mattered to my sister and me because our sweet ride had something far more important to us, a rear-facing seat in the cargo bay that we used to refer to as the way, way back. This might not sound like a big deal now, but to the 10 and under crowd in 1975, it was absolutely mind-blowing. On long trips, we were allowed to sit in the way, way back and look at the fronts of the cars behind us instead of the backs of the cars in front of us for a change. We get to wave and yell and make stupid faces at all the unfortunate drivers who ended up having to follow us, while Mom and Dad, who were sitting a half a mile away up front, got some well-deserved peace and quiet. It was, as the saying goes, a win-win situation for the whole family. In retrospect, I realized what made this experience, or at least part of what made this experience so compelling, was the opportunity to observe things from a different perspective. Suddenly, I could look in reverse and move forward at the same time. I could make eye contact with the person in the car behind me with my back to my parents who were sitting in front of me. Riding around in that jump seat in my parents' Ford presented me with a novel way of looking at the world. In today's reading from Luke, Jesus presents his disciples with a new lens through which they might see and understand some things that they thought they'd already seen and understood. These verses appear at the start of what's known as Jesus' Sermon on the Plain. To put things in context, the scene takes place right after Jesus has descended from the mountain he had climbed in order to pray. While he was up there, he called his disciples and appointed 12 of them apostles. Now, he's back on level ground, along with the apostles, the disciples, and a great multitude of people from all Judea, Jerusalem, and the coast of Tyre and Sidon. Because the former were Jewish cities and the latter were Gentile cities, Luke's implying that what Jesus says and does here is going to be relevant for everyone. In the midst of this chaos, with a desperate crowd reaching out towards Jesus to find healing, Luke abruptly changes focus. He tells us that Jesus looked up at his disciples to address them directly, to explain to them what ministering to the needs of this crowd and to the needs of the world will really be like. And we have the privilege of eavesdropping on that speech. Jesus begins with a series of four brief sayings commonly known as the Beatitudes, a term derived from the Latin word beatus, which means blessed or fortunate or happy. The form of these short blessings would have been familiar to Luke's audience because they appeared throughout Hebrew scriptures and in other writings at that time. They show up in Matthew's gospel too during the Sermon on the Mount with some important differences. We'll get to that later. Beatitudes were sayings that proclaimed someone's privilege or good fortune. For example, blessed are those who wear a mask and get vaxxed during a global pandemic, for they shall not get COVID, for example. Just saying. When used in a faith context, though, Beatitudes described a particular person or people as being favored by God. But if the form of these blessings was no surprise to Jesus' listeners, then the content of them, well, had to be a shock. Blessed are the poor, the hungry, those who weep, those who are hated, excluded, reviled, and defamed. What's a blessed or fortunate or happy about any of that? Who would actually want to be one of those people? But Jesus is clear that these are the people whom God blesses. As I said earlier, another very different version of the Beatitudes appears in Matthew during the Sermon on the Mount. And one obvious distinction is where these two speeches actually happen. There's a saying in real estate that the three most important features of a property are location, location, and location. And that's kind of true here too. The setting of these two versions of the same basic story is worth considering. Matthew situates his on top of a mountain, and this is no accident, because lots of really big things took place at altitude throughout the Old Testament. Like when Moses presented God's law to Israel. Remember that one? So if Matthew wanted to underscore the importance of what Jesus says, having him head up a mountain to say it was arguably a good way to do that. The story of Moses was familiar to Matthew's first readers, and they would have understood that Matthew was encouraging them to see Jesus as the new Moses. But Luke does something quite different. He has Jesus come down from the mountain to preach upon a level place among the crowd. This idea, coupled with the gathering of Jews and Gentiles from across the region, serves to underscore two essential ideas for Luke. The immediacy of Jesus' message, it's meant for us in the world we live in now, and its universality, it's meant for everyone. Luke takes the concept of Emmanuel, God with us, really, really seriously. This is all corroborated by Luke's recounting of what Jesus actually says, which is far more direct and urgent than what Matthew says. Just listen. Blessed are the poor in spirit, says Matthew. Blessed are the poor, says Luke. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, says Matthew. Blessed are you who are hungry now, says Luke. While Matthew's Beatitudes seem to be focused upon ethereal issues like spiritual poverty and the hunger for righteousness, Luke's are concerned with immediate social problems like actual poverty and actual hunger. But the disparities between these two versions of the Beatitudes begs the following question. Which one's right? Was Jesus up on a mountain talking to his disciples in private about spiritual things? Or was Jesus down on the plain talking to those disciples in the midst of the masses about practical things? Was it both? I mean, did Jesus preach two different versions of his sermon in two places on separate occasions? I have to admit, I've done that myself. Was it neither? Did none of this ever actually happen? Or did each of these writers take a basic kernel of fact and run in different directions with that kernel in order to support their respective agendas? I don't know. I wasn't there. And I dare say neither were you. At the end of the day, we're left to work this out for and amongst ourselves. And it's totally understandable that we might disagree, or, dare I say, even change our minds, as we do all of that in our place and time. Maybe one of the reasons these two stories exist alongside one another in the New Testament is to provoke that kind of dialogue across difference. And we need to remember that these stories can speak truth whether or not they happen to be factually accurate. At their very best, stories invite us to see all sorts of things in new and unique ways. One distinctive feature of Luke's account of the Beatitudes is the woes. Oh, those woes. Matthew gives us 9 blessings, Luke just 4. Luke chooses to counter those blessings with parallel woes. And they're kind of uncomfortable. Small wonder people tend to focus on Matthew's Beatitudes more than Luke's. If you're riding in the back of your limousine or your Lexus as you hear the sermon on the plane, it might not sound like particularly good news. But if you've ever been forced to sit in the back of the bus, it probably does. Wherever you happen to find yourself sitting, Jesus' description of God's reign turns the world upside down. It levels the playing field. It changes the entire game. And that's the whole point. People tend to listen to the woes and understand them as being punishments for being rich or full or happy or liked. For example, when Jesus says, "Woe to you who are rich," your interpretation of this statement might vary depending on how wealthy you are, but it's typically construed as a threat of reprisal, whether your reaction happens to be yay or uh-oh. But I have to wonder whether it's really that simple. I mean, what if these woes are ultimately the consequences of seeing the world through a human lens instead of God's lens? If God's reign is defined by no one being poor, by no one going hungry, by no one weeping, by no one being excluded, then those who derive their own value from being richer or fuller or happier or more beloved than other people are going to be pretty disappointed when that reign is made real, when the game is changed, when the playing field is leveled. And maybe the discomfort that some people feel about Jesus coming down from that mountain, getting up in our faces, and taking us to task about our lack of care for the poor and the hungry and the sad and the hated among us stems from the possibility that God's reign is not simply some abstract, distant ideal that we're just supposed to wait around for, but one that we're called upon to make real right here and right now. Don't you see? The game's already different than we thought it was.